Welcome to the Determined Truth Podcast.
What the truth? You can't handle the truth.
Where we aim to explore questions of truth, the scriptures, and what it means for the church today. Here are your hosts, Rob Dalrymple and Vinny Angelo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome in. It's been a whole week, if you're listening in real time. It seems like 1,000 years, but it's just been 7 days. But last week we weren't able to finish our discussion on the millennium. We are in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 10. So let's jump back into that so we don't leave the people waiting any longer. It was just a short time, just 3.5 year wait.
Yeah, there you go.
How long, O Lord?
That's what people have been crying out. How long is it going to take for Vinny and Rob to finish this?
To finish the book of Revelation.
Exactly.
We're just delaying because we think the Lord's coming back soon, because we really don't know what the last couple chapters mean anyways.
Exactly.
So we're faking it.
But do we want to recap anything? Or
I think that'd be good. We talked last week if you listen, we're trying to see if we can fit this all into one episode. And hey, let's see if we can do it. And then we didn't even come close. And then I realized, I think what we're actually going to do, if you're listening today, this might be a little bit shorter of an episode to hopefully focus the conversation even more specifically on the millennium. And then next week, we'll probably come back to it again. And I think, as you and I were talking about, the reviewing a little bit and going over it every time at the beginning is helpful and processing. And I think if we tried to slam everything into this one episode today, it would actually be too much, because believe it or not, the Armageddon passage is actually an important aspect to this conversation on the millennium. So let's just begin, Vinny, just briefly with reminding our listeners what the three views of the millennium are. We talked about a little bit before that we don't want to be like labeled with one of the views, because there are always aspects of each of these views that we may not agree with. But you basically have premillennialism, postmillennialism, and amillennialism.
Well, and before we define the three, let's remind ourselves the millennium, because when you're dealing with these prefixes of pre, post, and it's describing the millennium, which is the reign of Christ.
Yes.
So if you're getting confused on what this millennium is, it represents the reign of Christ. So it's, does Christ return before his reign, after his reign, or is he there during his reign? Is that a simplified way of saying it? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe we can even say it refers to 1,000-year reign of Christ, hence or millennium. Although whether that 1,000 years is an actual literal 1,000 years or not, that might be subject to discussion. Yeah, so you've already defined it all pretty well. Premillennialism and postmillennialism. The way to distinguish those two is to say, when does the second coming happen with regard to the millennium? Pre-millennialism says second coming happens first, prior to. And that big argument for them is going to be chronology, right? That the order of events in Revelation 19 and Revelation 20, Christ returns in 19 verses 11 through 16. And then in 21 through 10, we have the discussion of the millennium, Christ returns, then the millennium, very obvious. Post-millennialism says Christ returns after the millennium, obviously not chronological then, and the idea that Christ literally reigns on earth for 1,000 years, but he reigns in the hearts of believers, whereas maybe I should go back. Premillennialism says because Christ returns before the millennium, he actually literally reigns on earth himself in Jerusalem, and we can discuss that more if we need to as we proceed. So post-millennialism says Christ actually reigns, but he reigns in the hearts of believers. The world becomes Christianized, and basically the whole world, or almost all the world, is Christian for 1,000 years, though that may not be a literal number. It probably isn't for post-millennials. And then Christ returns. And then amillennialism, which is a misnomer, because the word the letter A in front of a Greek word, means no, or it negates it, like atheism, no God, no theism. Amillennialism does not mean that there's no millennium. It just means that there's no literal 1,000-year reign of Christ as proposed in pre and post millennialism. And again, premillennialism says it's a literal reign of Christ because he actually returns and rules from Jerusalem. Post millennialism says there's a literal reign of Christ because the world's becoming Christianized, even though Christ is not reigning himself literally, he's reigning through the hearts of believers. Amillennialism says it just refers to this 1,000-year period of time where Christ is reigning from heaven. Please don't make the sacred secular divide between those two, because Christ rules from heaven, but he rules through us. It's not quite the same way a post-millennialist would say, but the idea is that Christ is presently reigning through his people. His reign, however, is from his throne in heaven, and then he'll return at the end to establish his kingdom. There you go. That was simple.
We want to make sure, too, that this is such a low shelf basic description of these things.
Yes, yes.
We definitely want to say that there are brilliant, faithful saints in all three of these camps. And there's, we want to make sure that we're not just being simplistic at all these things. There's a lot more that could be said. We don't want to misrepresent any one of these views. There's a lot more that could be said on all these views. There's millions of pages that have been spilt, or ink that's been spilt on millions of pages to describe all these views. So there is more to that. Wherever you land, even if you're listening to this, you're not, this isn't a question of orthodoxy in terms of where you, what camp you might sit in and what you believe. We have a position on where we might be, but this isn't one of those things that you reject sharing the communion plate with someone because they would think differently in this topic.
But interestingly, by the way, and you fully know this, there's a lot of people that would disagree with that, right?
Exactly.
There are people that are firmly embedded in some of these camps that think this is an issue to not share the communion plate with. This is an issue of orthodoxy. But what I think you're trying to get at is the fact we do have brothers and sisters in Christ across the spectrum. Yeah, and we discussed last week. I think for me, and you can reiterate what you'd like if you wish, for me, the issue is the reign of Christ.
Yes.
Whatever you say about that, in other words, I have no problem saying that Christ reigns presently, and that's probably what we would call the millennium. Mm-hmm. But if he comes back and actually starts reigning from Jerusalem, yes, I was wrong. I don't think that's going to happen because I think that, but that's okay. And we can fellowship together along with that. Some of these viewpoints have a militancy side to them. So we would not include them and say, okay, there are some extremisms, but I think what you're just trying to get at is, hey, as brothers and sisters in Christ, can we find a way to move forward even amongst our disagreements? So,
this ought to be one of those things that we show charity to other Christians with, in the same way that as a Baptist and a Presbyterian,
I was just going to go there. Yeah.
Yes. Like neither one of us is going to admonish us the other, because I would say, no, you ought to be a professing believer to be baptized. And you're like, no, sprinkle the babies.
I was just going to go down that path. Yeah. I was going to say, you and I are modeling this because you don't even baptize babies. Right.
And my thing is like, why do you baptize babies at church? Give them a bath at home.
No, you're bringing them into the covenant family of God. Yeah, you guys just do it with like presence in a separate room where you, what do you call that? You call it a dedication. We call it a baptism. Just put some water on it. We're good. Yeah.
So, I actually,
so we're modeling this.
I was going to say, I'm actually not even a believer in dedications. Our church practices, but I don't think.
Oh, that's because you don't want to give any credence to my baptismal ideas, right? Yeah, that's given too much. But anyways, the point I was making is we don't even like each other. So us coming together every week, just modeling civility to put this podcast together is actually a really good example. And again, it's the cross that I bear.
We don't even talk throughout the week. Every time I log on, I'm like,
okay, honey, pray for me.
Yes, exactly.
I'm going in the wilderness.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. Get behind me, Satan, Rob.
You're doing this whenever you're not on camera.
That's exactly what I actually have my holy water and all the stuff. I'm a Baptist, but I practice my Catholic icons here just to protect myself against the computer screen.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
So anyway, last week, one of the comments that you made is that Revelation 20, actually getting back to the passage that is talking about the millennium, it shouldn't be read chronologically. And we need to, while chapter 19 precedes it, we need to understand that the timeline that's happening actually is jumbled. John isn't trying to present a literal timeline in which the events of chapter 19 literally precede the events of chapter 20. Because what we saw in that chapter 19 was a final judgment. So why would you have final judgment and then have part two happening in chapter 20?
And again, the premillennialists would say, because that final judgment is what's necessary to bring about the millennial reign of Christ on earth. Okay. But and I think we discussed this a little bit. Now that I think about it, Vinny, like even on our first episode when we did the second coming of Christ, because we set the stage for this section of the book, chapter 19, verse 11 to chapter 20, verse 8. So again, what you have is three parallel sections of the judgment of the enemies of Christ. 19, 17 through 21, the judgment of the beast and the false prophet. 20, 1 through 10, the judgment of the dragon or Satan. 20, 11 through 15, which we'll discuss in a few episodes, the judgment of death and Hades. And in each one of them, they're thrown in the lake of fire. Clearly a literary construction of three parallel units to describe the final judgment that I think I would agree with you that takes place at the return of Christ where the enemies are slain, because 19, 17 through 21 kind of follows immediately on that. So not a problem. The other thing about the millennium passage, now let's just looking at this text here in chapter 20, verses 1 through 10. And I realized when I was going through the edits that we made some statements, but when we read the text and we made some comments about it. But I think it'd be good to go through it a little bit more methodically to make sure everyone's tracking with us. What happens in 21 through 10, I was about to say, what happens in 21 through 10? Stay. Okay. But that's just my mind going off. Okay. So if we have three parallel accounts, 19, 17 through 21, 21 through 10, 2011 through 15, that describes the enemies of God, of Christ, and they're all being thrown in the lake of fire. All we really need in this section here, or this unit here, 21 through 10, is verses 7 through 10. In verses 7 through 10, Satan's released from the abyss. He makes war against Christ and his armies. Fire comes down from heaven and devours them. And then he's thrown in the lake of fire. That's all you need. Verses 7 through 10 fit the context. So that raises the question, what are verses 1 through 3 and verses 4 through 6 doing? So let's look at that again. Let's go to chapter 20 and read verses 1 through 3 if you want to pick it up, or I can either way.
Sure.
Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3. And then I'll explain what I think, what I'm thinking about that.
Okay. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the pit, and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while.
Okay. Now, I'm going to go to chapter 12 for a second. And it says in verse 7 and 8, or 7, 8, and 9, that there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels were waging war with the dragon. This is Revelation 12, verse 7. And the dragon and his angels waged war. And they were not strong enough. There was no longer a place found for them in heaven. The great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who's called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth. And the reason for pointing that out, I didn't finish the end of verse 9, but that's okay. It makes the point here, is that verses 1, 2, and 3 of Revelation 20 seem to be explaining or introducing the devil or the dragon as if he's never been introduced before, but he has been introduced. He laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who was the devil and Satan. We already knew that. So
it's so redundant for a first-time introduction, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So then the next part then becomes verses 4 through 6 are this interruption. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to introduce us to the dragon, and if the point of this unit is to describe the defeat of the dragon or his judgment being thrown into the fire, then what are verses 4 through 6 doing here? Because they have, do you want to read them again now, Vinny? Because this has nothing to do with the judgment of the dragon. And the answer is it has to have something to do with it, which we'll discuss. Go ahead, read verses 4 through 6 if you want.
Then I saw thrones, and seated on them were those to whom the authority to judge was committed. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God, and those who had not worshiped the beast or its image and had not received its mark on their forehead or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years.
So it's pretty apparent that verses 4 through 6 is an interruption, and we'll discuss this a little bit more, but we mentioned it, I think, last week and obviously a few times previously. The same thing happens in the Armageddon account. You have this description of Armageddon, and then all of a sudden, blessed are those who stay awake and keep their garments with them. You're like, and almost every English translation puts verse 15 of Revelation 16 in parentheses. It's a parenthetical note. It's an interruption. Well, if you look at the text carefully in Revelation 20, verses 4 through 6 also are pretty clearly marked off as an interruption, because look at verse 3. It says, Satan will not deceive the nations until the 1,000 years were completed. Mm-hmm. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Verse 7, when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released. Verse 7 is clearly picking up where verse 3 left off. That makes verses 4 through 6 kind of this interruption. And then one last thing to note for now, and that is verses 4 through 6 are actually in the very middle of this whole section. So we discussed in our first episode on this section that from chapter 19:11 through 21:8, we have this section that is in between the account of the harlot and the account of the bride, clearly marked off in between these two sections. That section, this section, begins with the second coming of Jesus, 19:11 through 16, And then Christ comes down. And then 21 verses 1 through 8 are introduction to the descent of the New Jerusalem. The New Jerusalem doesn't descend, but it's introduced. It's about to descend. So that's the opening and the closing. In the middle are these three sections that we just discussed, the judgment of the three enemies of Christ. And in the middle of the middle one, so the middle one is 20 verses 1 through 10, and the account of the millennium, or the account of the judgment of Satan. But in the middle of that section, verses 4 through 6, are God's people who reign with Christ for 1,000 years. So that itself tells us it's very prominent and something very important, very significant is going on.
Okay.
By the way, it's obvious, it's pretty easy, isn't it? I mean, if anyone's not tracking with us now, there's just no hope that they're ever going to figure this out. I think we made it as plain as day.
I'm just shocked at the stupidity of our listeners that it's taking them this long to get it.
They're writing us notes. Can you say it again? Come on. Exactly. All right. Yeah, right. That's why we had the 10,000 letters that came in last week that made it say, okay, we're going to make this three episodes because obviously, yeah.
So last week you argued that it makes sense to suggest that the millennium, which is this 1,000-year period where Satan is described as being bound in an abyss, is present reality. This is something that we should expect now. It's not a future thing.
And we discussed
that because we look around, we see the crap that exists in the world. Like things suck. It's not fun. Every day there's just bad. I'm in a big church. We constantly get prayer requests from congregants. It let us know how bad things are. People have heart attacks, strokes, things get broken into, evil that happens. Isn't that a pretty good argument to say that no, Satan is not bound now? There's still death and evil and destruction in the world. That's just personal experience. That's not even paying attention to the wars that happen and all the other stuff we see.
I think you, and I understand exactly where you're going with that, and I understand the argument. I would think that would be an argument that you would try to make to say Christ isn't presently ruling in any sense at all, whether it's a millennial rule or not. And it's just no. Clearly, we have what we call the already not yet, the both and, that Christ is reigning and he's defeated death and conquered sin, yet sin and death still remain because, as we discussed throughout our study of the book of Revelation, it's God's justice, it's God's mercy, granting them time to repentance while God's people faithfully go out and proclaim the gospel. That's why we have this already not yet, but we clearly have the new creation's already begun, 2 Corinthians and Galatians, this language of new creation, yet the new creation's not here in totality. Whether that has anything to do with the devil being bound or not, I don't think works for this reason. It would work if we assume that the binding of Satan is a literal binding of where he's completely bound. But what we discussed last week and what I presented last week was, if Satan's bound in Mark 3, and I'll get back to that in a minute, that doesn't mean he's completely bound in all aspects, because as you go through the gospel stories, Jesus says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan," after that binding of Satan. Satan influences Peter's remark about Jesus being the Christ and not suffering. Satan entered Judas, the Gospel of John says. So Satan's still active. That doesn't mean that the point of the binding of Satan would be, the argument of the amillennialist camp would be, the binding of Satan is so that he will not deceive the nations any longer. That's what 20 verse 3 says. But it's not a complete, total binding where he can't do anything at all. And then the other thing I would add to your point would be, and this, I think, where the post-millennialism goes bad, and that is, if Satan's bound and the world's Christianized, then it's going to be a pretty good world. And even pre-millennialism is going to have this problem. Jesus returns, Satan's thrown in the abyss, he rules from Jerusalem, and it's going to be basically a good place because everybody's going to be Christian. The answer is, that doesn't make it inherently a good place, because Christianity has done a lot of really bad things over time. And just Christianizing the world doesn't solve the problem, because even Christians get corrupted by power. Even Christians get corrupted by sinful nature and lust and temptations and all those things. Now, the one response a pre-millennialist might give to that is, yeah, but if Jesus is reigning from Jerusalem and there's immediate judgment, you're going to be less likely to sin. As we sin today because we get away with it, or we think we might get away with it. So we have this whole schema. And I just question the veracity of that whole schema. But go back to the original question, then, and I would say this. What we discussed last week is that the only parallel to Revelation 20 in this millennium account, verses 4 through 6, is Mark chapter 3, in the sense that we have no other reference anywhere in the scriptures to 1,000 years. You do have the new creation of Isaiah that we alluded to, but we didn't discuss, and maybe Isaiah 65 and Isaiah 11. And you could try to read those two passages in light of the millennium. But Isaiah 65 actually says, I saw a new heavens and a new earth. And that fits more with Revelation 21 than it fits with Revelation 20. So I think that's problematic. I guess I should cover myself or clarify for the sake of the premillennialists. The premillennialists would say, Isaiah 65 says a new heaven and a new earth, but it goes on to say people will die at age of 100 and that'll be young. Mm-hmm. Revelation 21 says, I saw new heavens and a new earth, link in the two passages, but there's no more death. And therefore the premillennialist says, oh, Isaiah 65 must be talking about the millennium. You can see the problematic nature of it. The point, though, is the only passage that seems to be parallel, I think it is, and I understand that not everyone's going to agree, is Mark chapter 3 that we discussed last week, and just to review for the sake of our listeners. And that is in Mark 3, Jesus says, I entered the strong man's house and I bound him, and that's how I'm able to cast out demons, because they were accusing him of working in cahoots with the devil, and that's how he's casting out demons. And Jesus says, how can a kingdom, a house against itself, it's divided, I cannot stand. I'm not working in cahoots with the devil. I'm working against them. In fact, I already bound him. And really problematically for Jesus's listeners was the house of Israel is the house in which the devil's in. And I had to bind him from working within this house. And I've bound him. And that's how I'm able to do the work of the kingdom. And of course, the parable in Mark 4 about the sower goes out to sow. And some of the seeds fall upon the roadside and the devil snatches it away so that they can't seek into the soil is Jesus's response by means of a parable to say, you guys are the ones deceived by the devil, not me. So the devil's active and working so much so that he snatches the seeds, even though he's been bound. And I think if that's the case, it would argue that the binding in Revelation 20 is not a total binding, where he can't do anything. He still roams the earth seeking whom he may devour, as Peter says. But it's a limited binding in the sense that so that he can't deceive the nations any longer. And then one more thing, as we discussed last week, because of that, the Gentile mission is able to take hold. And the gospel goes out to the nations, not because everyone is no longer deceived, but because not everyone is deceived. And some will come to faith.
I think for me, this point, coming from a premillennial dispensational background and moving over into a more covenantal, amillennial-ish, but more covenantal viewpoint, this is one of the things that really hung me up for a long time.
Okay.
And because I was constantly hearing the voice that I was brought up with, which was, no, Satan can't be bound because there's still awfulness in the world.
Yeah. Okay. All right, good.
Coming to that purpose clause in verse 3 where it says so that this is the reason why I am binding him so that he cannot deceive the nations any longer. And a couple things shifted my paradigm on this. One, the reason for this is Satan be bound because now this is Great Commission language. So Jesus could commission his followers to go into all the nations and preach the gospel. Something that when you see the Old Testament story, it's people are not flocking to Israel. Israel is set apart and the nations aren't wanting to come and worship their God. And so there's just that, like taking the purpose clause seriously. But then even something like, I forget if I've shared the story before here. I used to judge marching band competitions. Like that was one of my judges, a musician, one of my jobs.
I was asked, but I said, no,
you were asked, but you're like, nah, I'm not too hard.
I don't have time. I don't have time for that.
It's 11 or 12 years ago. I forget how long it was. I went up to, I think it's Logan, Utah, where a Utah State is at. Okay. And so we had a competition at the football field there. And I remember flying in the night before Saturday morning, just walking around Logan. And it's this gorgeous town. And it was the fall. This is something that you see in a Norman Rockwell type painting. And it's just, this community is unbelievable. I'm walking around all morning and it's just beautiful. And I look it up. This is one of the most safest cities in America, right? Not just in Utah, but in the whole of America. I just felt this peace there, whereas I could have left my hotel door open when I was gone and no one would have broken it. It was one of those type of things. And you look up, it's 99% Mormon and that sort of thing. And what I realize is if the hope is that Satan needs to be bound so bad stuff doesn't happen to me, that's almost being deceived in itself on the purpose of what Satan does, where it's not just so I could have a better life and that's why we need Satan bound. Living in Logan, Utah, just knowing the statistics of what Mormon folks have to deal with, yet the devil might not be living there in the traditional sense of it's not downtown Oakland, right? Mm-hmm. It's not crime. Mm-hmm. It's not, we're not worrying about drive-by shootings. We're not worrying about drugs and that sort of things, street drugs. But you are dealing with a community that is so completely rocked by behaviorism and moralism. Mm. The rates of depression for LDS folks is so high. The rate of substance abuse for prescription drugs is so high. It's just because you're living under this unrealistic pressure to be perfect.
Yeah, and religious pressure.
And it's, yeah, while it's safer, while you might have better quote-unquote neighbors living in Logan, Utah, where I don't have to worry about a drive-by, I don't have to worry about someone ripping off my stuff, my kid being, you know, exposed to drugs, it's just as lost. It's in a moralistic kind of way. And that's where it's like, when we just make the binding of Satan being about physical safety or not wanting to have neighbors who look like Oakland or whatever, or wherever your city is in your part of America, we're just missing the point. The point is about the gospel, and the point is about Satan is bound so the gospel could go out to the world. For me, once I started having those shifts, I just started understanding the text in a different kind of way.
Yeah. And boy, there's so many conversations we can have here too, because what looks like, take a place like where you live and say Black Hawk or some of the wealthier communities, white collar crime could be even more insidious than inner city crime in Oakland. They're doing actually more damage, but it's a really good point that you're making in terms of, I don't know that we can say this categorically, because the Genesis 3 story, sin comes into it because the devil is indeed tempting.
Yeah.
But I don't think we necessarily need the devil to be bad people.
Right? No, not at all.
I think the nature of humanity is such, and I think this is an important caveat also, and that is, as by the time this goes live, we will have already done one live stream on Christian nationalism and a second live stream coming up. And the idea that if we can make this a Christian nation with Christian laws, it'll be a better place. And the answer is that just doesn't work. That's not true.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not a better place for people that don't adhere to Christianity, because now they're imposed a religion. And I think that's the antithesis of the gospel. And as you're saying, what it's really about is the kingdom flourishing and the kingdom expanding, not having comfortable lives and a more moral community and a safer community. It's about those things, but especially the flourishing of the kingdom, where there's justice for the sake of the poor and the oppressed and the marginalized, and God's name is being known because we love our neighbors and love our enemies the way God loves us. So,
yeah.
So we're certainly not going to finish this conversation in one episode now.
Exactly. I was going to say we read verses 4-6, but is there anything else in verses 1-3 that you wanted to look at? Or
I think verses 1-3 are actually really critical to understanding what's going on. We might actually finish with 1-3 here.
Okay.
Let's see how it goes.
We hope you're enjoying the podcast, and we want to remind you that everything we do at Determined Truth, the podcast, Rob's blog, and our YouTube channel is available on the Determined Truth app. Directions on how to download the app is available in the show notes and on the DeterminedTruth.com website. Just click on the app tab.
So I think that there's several things I would want to say about chapter 20, verses 1, 2, and 3. And there's a little bit of uncertainty here. So again, I'm not saying that this is the crux of the matter, that everything I believe on the Millennium Passage kind of hinges on this. But I did notice that verses 1, 2, and 3 actually raise some questions when I began to examine the text carefully and the way the structure and John's rhetorical objectives are. And I began to realize there's questions here that I don't think any other scholars have actually raised, because I don't think they saw some of these things there. So first off, I think that there's a parallel between chapters 20, verses 1 through 10, this account, and chapter 9. Now, chapter 9 that we really glossed over, and we glossed over it because of this passage here. And that is verses 1 through 19 basically describe the fifth and sixth trumpets. And they're demonic hordes that come up and wage war, okay? And I think that the parallels of the fifth and sixth trumpets actually fit with this war that Satan wages when he's released from the abyss in verse 7. This is the war. And this war is also connected with the war of Armageddon. And again, the problem with saying that is I know what I mean, and I think I know what the text is saying, but I know that we as listeners, that what's happening is we're filtering that through what I think Armageddon means or what I think the millennium means. So let's see if we can flesh that out. Let me notice some parallels. And there's six of them. Maybe by next week I'll come up with a seventh, because there just has to be seven, because right now we can't leave it at six. All right. First off, chapter 9 and chapter 20. So the parallels between 9 and the fifth and sixth trumpets and 20 and this account of Satan being judged in what we call the millennium. Both have a heavenly being descend who has a key to the abyss. And it's the only two times. And
so you would say that this is the same abyss then?
It says that John wants us to link the two accounts.
Okay.
There's only one abyss. So as far as your answer is concerned, yeah, it's the same abyss. There's only one abyss. But when John links two passages by using rhetorical language of repeating something, another angel here or a strong angel there and a strong angel there, oh, these two passages are linked by the reference to a strong angel, as we saw in chapter 5 and chapter 10 and then later on in chapter 18.
So in the same way that in chapter 7 and chapter 14, we see 144,000, we should assume it's the same 144,000. It's the same thing here.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Even more, that's an easier one, though. But this is clear that he's using the repetition of an angel with a key to the abyss, and it only occurs twice.
Okay.
Chapter 9 and chapter 20 have to be linked somehow. So now the question becomes, how are they linked? And of course, secondly then, you have the demonic hordes in the fifth and sixth trumpets are linked with the account of the war, which is happening in chapter 16, 12 through 16. And I said we have to get to the Armageddon passage, and we'll get to it as we proceed. But let me introduce that topic now. The war in chapter 16, 12 through 16, that's the Armageddon passage. The war in 19, 17 through 21, that's the account of the judgment of the beast and the false prophet, and they're thrown in the lake of fire. And the war in chapter 20, verses 7 through 10, are clearly parallel to those three accounts. And I think the war that the demonic horde wages in the fifth and sixth trumpets is also parallel. So let me make that link, and we'll get to the link between the three accounts that reference the war, probably not this week. So here we go. The term war, the word war, the noun, occurs 9 times in the book of Revelation. Now, you may have heard us say, or me say, that the war occurs 7 times. And that's because the war occurs 7 times. There's 2 other times where the word war occurs, and it's actually both in chapter 9, but it's not the war. So chapter 9, verse 7, referring to this demonic horde that comes out of the abyss, verse 7, the appearance of the locust was like horses prepared for, my translation says battle, but it's the Greek word for war. Mm-hmm. It's just not the war. Right? Because obviously it's not describing the war, it's just saying they're prepared for war or for battle.
For any kind of
battle. Yeah, exactly. And then in verse 9, it says, they had breastplates like the breastplates of iron, the sound of the wings like the sound of many chariots, of horses rushing to, again, it's war. So there's that word war occurring 2 other times, clearly in a distinct way from the war that occurs 7 other times.
It seems just descriptive. It's almost an adjective at this point. Like we're prepared to do this thing. I'm not telling you which thing it's going to be. It's just this thing.
Yeah, exactly. And the other 7 accounts of the war are certainly linked, and we'll discuss that more as we proceed. That's the third point. The fourth point is the sixth trumpet in chapter 9 and the war of Armageddon in the sixth bowl are linked because they both refer to the Euphrates.
Hmm.
In fact, the word Euphrates, the Euphrates River, occurs only twice. So once in chapter 9, verse 14, it says, release the 4 angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. So there's the first account. And the second time is in chapter 16, verse 12, it says the sixth angel poured out his bowl in the great river, the Euphrates. Guess what? It's the only 2 times the word Euphrates occurs in the book of Revelation. Hmm. And again, if it's the only 2 times, it's very likely that those passages are supposed to be connected with one another. Most people have no problem because it's the sixth trumpet and the sixth bowl, and they like linking the 7 trumpets and the 7 bowls together. I don't think that's what's going on in terms of the whole scheme of the bowls and trumpets, but note they do. My point is the war in chapter 16, verses 12 through 16, it's the same war, and I'll discuss that later on, that happens in chapter 19 and happens in chapter 20. In fact, I'll show you, Vinny, later on when we look at the notes. The Greek is identical in chapter 16 and chapter 20. It's identical, and it's a slight variation in chapter 19. Clearly, John's linking the war in chapter 16 and the war that Satan wages when he gets out of the abyss in chapter 20. So if the war in 16, which is Armageddon, and the war when Satan gets out of the abyss is linked, and it's identical language, it has to be linked. It likely has to be linked. But yet the war in 16 is linked with demonic horde in chapter 9 by the word Euphrates. Ah, so I think chapter 9, after chapter 20, something's going on, and that'll be the question that we want to address. right, the fifth argument. The sixth trumpet, John states that the demonic horde in chapter 9, verse 19 says that in their mouths and in their tails is where they have power.
Hmm.
So with their tails, they do harm, because with their mouths and with their tails, they have power. And then in chapter 16, verse 13, again, the sixth trumpet and the sixth bowl are linked by Euphrates. And now they're linked again because they both refer to the mouth. So in chapter 16, verse 13, he says, I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits that look like frogs. So they're unclean spirits, and they're coming out of the mouth of, and the demonic horde in chapter 9 have mouths.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't say the verbal link is necessarily there, but we have a thematic link, right? The theme of demonic agents having power in their mouths, mm-hmm. links the two passages. All right, the sixth argument then, last one. Again, until we come up with a seventh, because we have to come up with seven, because we can't leave it at six, because that would be like an evil podcast.
Right.
The demonic horde in the fifth and sixth trumpets parallel the description of the final judgment of Satan. So in chapter 20 that we already read, verse 2, the dragon's called the ancient serpent. And we're like, why are you describing the dragon as the ancient serpent? We already knew that was chapter 12. Well, guess what? In chapter 9, verse 19, it says, the power of the horse is in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents and have heads, and with them they do harm. So now we have a link between serpents. And that seems to, again, another thematic link there. That link gains more strength, however, by the fact that the word serpent occurs five times. The first time, chapter 9, what we just read. The last time, chapter 20, that we just read. Mm-hmm. The other three accounts are all in chapter 12, where the dragon is introduced. So we know that the introduction, yeah. It's a French way of saying the word. So
that's French, right. Yes.
Yeah. The introduction to Satan in chapter 20 seemed unnecessary. Mm. And it linked with the introduction of the dragon in chapter 12 by the fact that it's like, you already introduced us to the dragon, and it says the same thing that happens in chapter 12. The point then is this. The dragon's called the serpent three times in chapter 12. He's also called the serpent, or the word serpent is also used in chapter 9, and then is also used in chapter 20. Hmm. So it seems that we have a link again. I wouldn't argue this one as strongly, but I'd say it's certainly thematically linked by the use of the word serpent. And the point then becomes these six arguments, and we need a seventh one, but these six arguments make a strong case. John wants us to read chapter 9 and chapter 20 in light of one another, or 20 verses 1 through 10 in light of one another. So that is probably enough for today. Maybe we'll leave it there and we'll pick up on that next time. I'll review a little bit of that. And what we're going to argue is, so here, let me give the one counter argument and then I'll respond to this next week. So here's our teaser for next week's episode. And that is, in chapter 9 opens with an angel coming down with a key to the abyss, and he opens it. And the demonic hordes come out for 5 months and a great smoke, and you know, for 5 months, and they can't kill. In chapter 20, an angelic being has a key to the abyss, and he throws Satan in it and he closes it.
So it would make sense from a literary standpoint or chronological standpoint to put chapter 9 at the conclusion of the chapter 20 event, is what you're saying.
I have to edit that out because you just gave everybody the answer. And I said, crap. We're going to leave this as a teaser for next week.
I didn't mean to do that. I ruined Christmas again.
So you didn't hear that. You didn't hear that.
I'm not the real Santa. I smell like beef and cheese. I'm sorry.
I know him. I know.
I'm sitting on a throne of lies.
All right. By the way, yeah, like we said earlier, we hate each other. We just laugh to make it sound like we don't.
Funny one, Rob.
Yeah, take it there. My Red Sox bombed your A's again.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, last night
we had more errors than hits, man. It was like
hits the two nights ago.
So yeah. Bad.
So anyway, so I will argue that. How's this? That I think that's what's actually going on. That John's reintroducing us to the devil as a new character because he wants us to go back to chapter 9, which means the dragon's already been thrown into the abyss. And in chapter 9, the abyss is then open and Satan's released. And that 5 months corresponds with the war in chapter 20, verse 7. We don't have to do another episode next week. Yeah, we'll do it anyways. We'll just review. All right, cool. We're good.
There you go. Awesome. So next week, we're still in chapter 20. So encourage everyone to go back and read through chapter 9 again, just to see how those parallels work.
Yeah.
And man, we're getting close.
Yeah. And let's also, I know we've already done it a little bit last week, and we hinted at it this week. Next week, we're also why this matters and what's significant. Because again, it's having these theological exercises to debate the millennial views and da-da-da, which for some people are a litmus test, as we said before. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. At the end of the day, what do we accomplish? What we hopefully accomplish is knowing what it means to follow Christ and take up our cross and follow him and bear his kingdom. And time out. Did I mention, I introduced Christian nationalism, but I didn't discuss it, didn't I? Did I?
Correct.
I had a total ADD moment. I mentioned to you earlier that we have some live streams coming up that will already have aired on Christian nationalism. And my point of that earlier was to say that when we try to say that when we Christianize the whole world because the devil's bound, we make the whole world Christianize, it makes the world a better place. That's fallacious and dangerous. Because of, for a lot of reasons that we'll discuss on the upcoming, on the live streams past as well as upcoming live streams, the first question becomes like, which version of Christianity becomes the one that's legalized? Yes. Mm-hmm. And what do we do with the other ones that aren't? Do we say, okay, it's the Baptist view, which is so ironic because the Baptists fled nationalism to come for religious freedom to America. Yet the Baptists are the primary proponents of Christian nationalism. But if it's the Baptist one, then do we actually make a law saying that you guys who baptize infants need to go to prison or pay a fine? It becomes really dangerous. So it's only just like which version of nationalism, but of Christian nationalism, but other problems come about as well. And
I was going to say with penal theological issues do we have where it's, you know, you're baptizing the wrong people. Therefore, if it is a Christian nation, there's going to be a consequence for those sorts of things if you're doing it wrong. So it makes sense that it's one of those things where the dominoes knock over where, okay, if you're going to go this route, what about?
Let's go one more step. And here we are making this 35-minute episode. It's going to be 50 by the time we're done.
Yeah.
But I think this is an important point. And I'm not saying this to bash the Baptists. Again, I grew up Southern Baptist. I got saved in the Baptist church, did wonderful things for me also. Because I think this, what happened in the Southern Baptist church is actually happening in other denominations as well. It just got unearthed emphatically in the Southern Baptist convention in the last couple of years. But the high level of sexual immorality that was happening amongst pastors and leaders in the Southern, and they were covering it up. Imagine if they were given governmental authority, governmental power, how big the cover-up would be. Because now what's happening is your goal and power of that nature is to stay in power. And you really don't want it to be exposed. And you have the power to cover it up. So you can see how much of a trouble it was, even within a denominational setting. Imagine if you add political power to that, it becomes, and obviously the Roman Catholic Church did that with popes killing other popes and popes even not covering up and having weddings for their granddaughters at the Vatican. I don't think wedding the church in power with power is a good idea for anyone. And I don't think it's a way to love our neighbor. I think, and we'll discuss this in upcoming live streams, I think a pluralistic political context actually is a way to say, I don't agree with you, but I love you and respect you enough that you can hold that view. Obviously, I'm going to make law saying that your view about abusing children is wrong or killing Jews for fun is wrong. We're going to make that illegal, but I think that's how we have to differentiate all that. Excellent.
Yeah. And one point that I'm thinking of, I know. One more thing.
I finished another episode is what I was going to say. Honey, I'm safe. No. I survived. Oh, never mind. He wants to go on longer. I'll be here just a couple more. Keep praying. Keep fasting. You can eat in 5 minutes. The whole church comes over so they can pray for me while I go through this.
It's intercessional prayer, for me. No, it just dawned on me as well. In the good news of chapter 20, is that Jesus not only gives us the command to go out into the world and fulfill the Great Commission, but he says, and I'm actually going to restrain the biggest opposition you had, which is the devil, so you could actually do this now. And so there's that negative side of thing, like you had this thing going against you that but I'm now restraining that. But also this is John 14. It's, and guess what? While you go out, I'm actually going to empower you with my spirit as well. So there's that positive where you're not just left merely with the spirit of God to do the work of God, but you're also doing it while the ultimate enemy of God is being bound. And it just, those parallels hit me for the first time. Obviously I've thought about them, but not together.
Cool. Very good. All right. Thank you.
Great. All right. So next week we are into finishing or going through more of chapter 20.
I think we'll finish 21 through 10 next week. Yes.
Okay. 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 Great. All right, everyone. Hope you're appreciating it. Keep listening to the podcast. Make sure to, we haven't said this in a while, leave some reviews. Get the algorithm going. So leave some reviews, especially on your Apple podcast. If there's there's always a good time to send in financial support if you want to do that for the ministry. So you could see, check out ways of doing that on DeterminedTruth. Is it .com?
Yeah,
forget .com. Yep. Forget .com.org. So you can check that out. And until then, we'll see you next week.